We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
You'll turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We come to an oft-quoted part of the Bible. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. It's oft-quoted because people want to use it in all kinds of different situations to call upon their fellow Christians to change their behaviour patterns, in particular in associations, in associations of a variety of kinds. It has been, of course, the great problem for Christianity since the settlement of this colony in the first place, that we are a mixed group. Mixed marriages have been the source of enormous pain and hurt within our community that I think has been a major contributor to alienating people from religion generally, because it has caused so much difficulty within homes. The mixed marriages that most commonly have caused the problem, though, have been interdenominational marriages. But this verse is the one that has been frequently used for that, just as it has been used for something more fundamental, that is, the Christian marrying the non-Christian, even within the same denomination. However, is that the problem that Paul is addressing when he says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers? It has been applied also to the pure church. Verse 17, come out from them and be separate, has been the call of many a holiness movement, many a group, section of the community, in the Christian community, who is calling upon us to be separate, not to be contaminated by the wickedness of evil denominations, but to be separate. Is that what Paul is writing about? Is that what he's calling us to do? It has also been used by those who want to separate ourselves from the world. Come out. Leave the evil. Do not be yoked with unbelievers. Have nothing, chapter 7, verse 1, to do with anything that will in any way contaminate the body or spirit. And therefore come out from the things of this world, whatever they may be that will contaminate us from our society, from the ways of the world, from its culture. And so a whole range of religious groups, Christian groups, have been challenged to leave behind the cultural forms which are considered to be contaminating. And they vary from 16th century Anabaptist groups who will have nothing to do with the government or society, warfare, of course, or paying taxes, which is something very popular amongst all Christians, if you can get that religiously away with. New tax, old tax, any tax. They have nothing to do with them. It's a very popular notion. I can think of certain sections that would flock to us today on that kind of message, but others have said we must not have anything to do with the society around about us in terms of its rock and roll or its TV or its pictures or going to the dance halls or whatever it may be. How do we apply this passage? How do we apply this passage, this challenge, this command of Paul to our situation in life? It is highly relevant. But its relevance gives us the problem because we're not quite sure exactly what area. So it's this little section at the end of chapter 6 which I particularly want us to pay attention to today, looking firstly at its simple meaning, what's it saying, and then trying to understand it in the context of Paul and of this epistle so we grasp its meaning properly before we'll apply it, and then hopefully we'll have a bit of time for questions because it raises so many issues about our relationships. So we'll try and get to if I can move quickly enough, to some question time as we come to the end, or comment time. Firstly, then, its simple meaning. It's an appeal to the Corinthians not to associate with unbelievers. The association there is of a partnership. It talks about not about having fellowship, about having things in common with unbelievers, about agreement with. It's not to enter into a partnership, a working partnership. The idea of yoking is a fairly straightforward one, but it stretches further in verse 1 to anything that is going to contaminate. And he uses two arguments as to why we're not to be yoked together. The first argument is inconsistency. It's a series of rhetorical questions. What have we got in common with each other? What has darkness got in common with light? What has the righteousness got in common with wickedness? What has the temple of God got to do with the temple of the idols? There is something fundamentally inconsistent with people of God and the people who are opposed to God being united. The second argument he uses is that of Scripture, around verse 16 and 17, 18. The Old Testament scriptures say that we are the temple of God because God says he will live with them and walk amongst them and be their God and they will be his people. We are the temple of God. And therefore, being the temple of God, we are to be holy. Therefore, touch no unclean thing. Come out, be separate, be holy. The word holiness means distinctive, separate, set aside from the rest. And so if we are to be God's temple, then we must be different. We must be set aside as a holy people. Not only are we the temple of God, but taking up the last verse 18 there of the quotations, which is a little hard to find exactly where the quotation is in Scripture because there's references in 2 Samuel 7 or Jeremiah or Isaiah that are like it. We are not only the temple of God, but we're the family of God. And just as families have their distinctive differences there, so we should have the distinctive difference of being the family of God. And so he draws the conclusion. As the temple of God, as the family of God, we should aim at holiness. We should purify ourselves. We should seek to perfect holiness. And therefore, we should keep ourselves separate from anything that is going to contaminate us. Anything that is anyway going to set back the process of becoming what we are. That is the holy people of God, the holy temple of God, the distinctive family of God. The passage in itself, in one sense, seems fairly simple and straightforward then in its meaning. But how do we apply it is the problem. What am I going to keep myself separate from? What is it about the unbelievers that I'm not going to have in common? Does this call upon the Christians to set up a completely different community within the community? Are we going to have our own garbage collection system, or can we use the local council ones? Do we need to set up our own school system, or can we use the local public school system? How far am I to be involved with them? Am I allowed to work with them, to trade with them? Can I enter into a business partnership with them? Where do you draw what lines from this? Well, to answer it, let's look firstly at the rest of Paul. We won't do all of it, of course. But from the rest of Paul, especially the Corinthian letters, we can see both what he does mean and what he doesn't mean. Let's look at what he doesn't mean, first of all. He doesn't mean that we're to leave the world. Back in chapter 5 of 1 Corinthians chapter 5, we have a similar passage where he writes, I have written to you in my letter, presumably referring to one that came before the Corinthians that we've lost, I have written to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral, or the greedy, or swindlers, or idolaters, for in that case you would have to leave the world. But I'm writing you that you must not associate with anyone who calls himself brother, who is sexually immoral, or greedy, or idolater, or slanderer, a drunkard, or a swindler. With such a man do not even eat. If it is that we're not to associate with the immoral, then of course we couldn't associate with anybody. But if we're talking about not associating with the Christian, the professed Christian who is immoral, then that would actually be something we could obey. So when he says don't associate, don't have anything to do with, don't be yoked together with unbelievers, he doesn't mean that we're to withdraw from all contact with all unbelievers everywhere. That's not on. That's not what he is meaning. That is an easy misunderstanding of his meaning. Nor does it mean that we're not to eat with the unbelievers. That's not to be the case either. There is the Jewish food laws, which gave the idea that certain foods would contaminate, whereas Paul freely ate with the Gentiles, in fact had a big argument with Peter in Galatians chapter 2 over whether or not you can eat with the Gentiles. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he's discussing eating food offered to idols. And what he concludes in that section, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 25, is, eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. You don't know what's happened in the local butcher shop, because the ancient butcher shop, all the meat was sacrificed and offered up to the idols. And so it would be easy enough with a Christian conscience to be walking in and saying, OK, has that steak there been offered to an idol, or is that one free of any idolatry? He says, don't go in like that. He says, go in and buy the steak. If someone says to you, hey, that's idol meat, then for his conscience sake you may refuse it, but for your conscience sake, a piece of steak's a piece of steak. And that's all it is, and the idol hasn't affected it one way or another, so eat heartily and enjoy it. Unless you're a vegetarian. Likewise, the subject of marriage. What if you're married to an unbeliever? Does that mean you should separate from them? Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 argues about that too, and he says to the married, verse 10 in 1 Corinthians 7, I give this command, not I, but the Lord, a wife mustn't separate from her husband. But verse down 12, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. That is, the unbelieving partner won't contaminate the believer. Rather, the believer will sanctify the unbeliever. And so therefore, when he's saying, do not be yoked, he's not saying, OK, I want you to split. I want you to leave your partner. The rest of Paul doesn't make that possible. Well, what did he mean? Again, if you go elsewhere in the writings of Paul and Corinthians, you can find things he does mean. For example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 to 8, I'll just summarise it, I won't read it for you now. He is saying that we are not to take believers to court. Say you and I have a fight together, Russell and Robert have a great fight. They are not to go to the government courts to settle the fight. They're not to take the matter before unbelievers to settle that dispute. If they're Christian brothers, it should be able to be sorted out in Christian fellowship within the congregational life. But it's not to be, we're not to be yoked with unbelievers in that regard, to bring the gospel into disrepute by taking court cases on. Or again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, when he talks about widows remarrying, at the end of the chapter on marriage, in verse 39, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. That is, in entering into marriage, one is not to be yoked with unbelievers. I don't think it's only entering into your second marriage that that is the matter. It seems to me that very few people had much choice in days of betrothal. But the one who did have the choice was the widow in terms of her remarriage. And in her remarriage, she was not to enter into marriage with an unbeliever. It says nothing about the widowers remarrying. That's because men, of course, die off earlier, being the weaker of the two, I presume. Then eating. While he says you don't go around asking questions about which kind of meat you eat in the shop, he also says in chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, in verses 14 to 22, that you're not to go into the idol temples. We're not to participate in idolatry. While you may eat the meat that has been offered to the idol, buying it at the local butcher shop, that's different from actually going into the idol temple and sacrificing the idol meat as well, because you're involving yourself in idolatry, and we're not to do that. In fact, he says, verse 14 of 1 Corinthians 10, flee from idolatry. Don't have anything to do with idolatry. Just as he said back in chapter 6 and verse 18, flee from sexual immorality. In other words, there are some things with Paul that he is saying we're not to have anything to do with, and there are other things he's saying that it's all right to participate in. So that when we come to our passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, do not be yoked together with unbelievers, we've got to be careful not to generalise that too far too quickly without thinking through all the implications. Now, I've just looked at the Corinthian correspondence. You could trace it through in Galatians and Ephesians and Romans and build up a whole picture of the ways in which we are to associate with unbelievers and the ways in which we're not to associate with unbelievers. So what does he mean in 2 Corinthians 6? And the way to find that out is to look at it in its context. So let's get back to chapter 6 and look at its context. First, its immediate context, and then its wider context of the rest of 2 Corinthians. In chapter 6, Paul is talking about his ministry and his life and ministry. He has been given, we're told at the end of chapter 5, a ministry of reconciliation. And verse 1, as God's fellow workers, we urge you not to receive God's grace in vain. Because now is the time, now is the opportunity, now is the occasion at which to receive the salvation that God has worked and has promised and has given us, given you and declared to you through our ministry. Then in verses 3 to 13, he talks about his ministry of that proclamation of God's work. He says, we put no stumbling block in anybody's path so that our ministry will not be discredited. Rather, as the servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way. And then he rattles through his hardships. Endurance, troubles, hardships, distress, beatings, imprisonments, riots, hard work, sleepless nights, hunger. It's a great job description. Few people would volunteer for it, and few people would want to take on somebody who's been through it. This sounds a most disreputable character when you see what he has gone through. He says, we have done all these things. And then in verse 14, he seems to change the subject about being yoked together. Until you come through to chapter 7 and verse 2, when he seems to change the subject again, although verse 2 and verse 13 seem very similar. Let me read to you a paragraph of the end of chapter 6, 11 and 12 and then jump straight down to 7:2, and you'll notice that it flows on as if verses 6:14 to 7:1 weren't needed. I pick up from verse 6:11. We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians, and opened wide our hearts to you. We're not withholding our affection from you, but you are withholding yours from us. As a fair exchange, I speak as to my children, open wide your hearts also. Make room for us in your hearts. We've wronged no one. We've corrupted no one. We've exploited no one. I do not say this to condemn you. You see how you can jump from one paragraph right down to the next, and it just flows on. It's almost as if, and some people have argued, chapter 6, verse 14 through to chapter 7, verse 1 was added in later by somebody else. I don't believe that. But it shows there is a consistent context in which this little section has been placed. I take it placed by Paul. In fact, I think you could argue that this is the reason for which this whole epistle has been written. Here's a very important point. The context is his appeal to be accepted by the Corinthians. He has poured out his life in love for them, and he is calling upon them to accept him. Because, as Tony pointed out for us a few weeks ago when we were looking at chapter 5, Paul and his message can't be separated. You can't believe what he has to say and not believe him. If you accept what he has to say, then you have to accept that he is the appointed servant of God to say it. And people who are rejecting him are rejecting the God who sent them. It's like that with any ambassador, isn't it? You can't say, yes, I accept your government, but I don't accept you. If you accept the government, then you accept the ambassador who comes in the name of the government. And courtesy is displayed to the ambassadors who come to Australia as an expression of our courtesy to the nations they represent. Here is the man who says, I represent God. God is willing to accept you back because of the death of his son on your behalf, and has sent me with that message to you. And if you reject me, it will be because you are rejecting that message and therefore God. There is the context. The clue is accepting Paul and his message. And the argument of the passage is about Paul's acceptance by the Corinthians. Paul, who is humanly so unacceptable, bashed up and beaten by everybody else, disreputable it would seem, Paul comes bearing the gospel. But notice what the gospel is. Of course, the gospel's about being executed. It's about being crucified, being dying and rising again and working peace through that. And so he will argue that his manner of life is consistent with the gospel. He comes proclaiming that man has crucified God. And you know what people did to him? They bashed him up and stoned him and left him for dead. You see, his life is consistent with the message he's preaching. Now, why is he going on about this? Well, if we look at the wider context in 2 Corinthians, we can understand. The easiest place to see it is in a couple of chapters down the track, chapter 11. God keeps holding so many ideas together in your head in one section in this passage, haven't you? But we'll get there in a minute. It'll all come clear if you're in a fog at the moment. Just if you keep all the jigsaw pieces, you need them all though. Don't throw any of them away, otherwise you won't be able to put the picture together properly. Down verse chapter 11. I hope you'll put up, he says, with a little of my foolishness. But you're already doing that. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid, just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray for your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. But I don't think I'm in the least inferior to those super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge, and we've made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I've kept myself from being a burden to you in any way, and will continue to do so. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Achaia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And I will keep on doing what I'm doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness, and their end will be what their actions deserve. What's Paul writing about? He goes to the church in Corinth and he preaches the gospel of God. And people come into relationship with God through this gospel. He leaves it to go elsewhere, and then others come. Others who come who are wolves. But all wolves, if they want to get amongst the flock, dress in sheep's clothing. They come as messengers of light, but in fact, of course, they are the messengers of darkness. But which messenger of darkness will we listen to unless he comes declaring himself to be the messenger of light? And so they come in amongst the congregation, and instead of being turned aside by a congregation who has grasped and understood the gospel properly, they've been welcomed in, even though they're preaching a different Jesus, even though they're preaching a different gospel. And naturally enough, when they're in the congregation, they start saying, hey, that Paul, he's not much of an apostle. I mean, nobody accepts him. Have you heard what they happened to him down in Philippi? He got stoned. That's actually with stones, not kind of like the new method of getting stoned. That's a different way of getting stoned. I just could see there was some confusion in minds there. Got thrown into prison. Do you hear what he did to him here or there? I mean, he's not, he And you know, he does it all for nothing. I mean, if he was a real preacher, they'd be paying him, wouldn't they? He does it for nothing. I mean, he's an amateur. He really doesn't know much about it at all. They will not accept the gospel that Paul preaches. They will not accept Paul. These are super apostles who boast of their own eloquence, their own learning, their own wisdom, their own qualifications, and who are acceptable to the congregation in Corinth. And so Paul is writing to the Corinthians and saying, hey, that's not right. Now, he's sent a message via a friend called Titus. And Titus has come back and said, the Corinthians still love you. You can find that in chapter 7, verse 4. We'll see it next week. The Corinthians still love you, Paul. It's all right. Paul's saying, okay, they still love me. They still want me. But they do not understand that they can't love and want me and the message I'm preaching and at the same time have these apostles and the message they're preaching. If they believe in the Jesus I'm preaching, they can't believe in the Jesus they're preaching. Just because we're using the same five letters, J-E-S-U-S, doesn't mean we're talking about the same thing. That's an old trick. It's a good one, but an old one. You use the same word to mean two different products. No, if I am the true apostle of Jesus Christ, they are false apostles. If my gospel is the gospel of truth, theirs is the gospel of lies. If I am representing God, they are representing Satan. We have nothing in common. And so the Corinthians in their generosity may be opening up their hearts to me, but they do not understand that to open up your hearts to me cannot at the same time include opening your hearts to the false apostles. And so in his appeal to them, to make room for us in your hearts, to open wide your hearts for us, he also has to say, do not be yoked with unbelievers. So here is the message, the meaning of what we're saying in chapter 6, verses 14 through to chapter 7, verse 1. This is what it is to be unequally yoked. It's an appeal to be true to the true apostles. Accept me in love, the love I have for you, and therefore to stop mixing the true and false apostles up together, the true and false gospels together, the true and false Jesuses together, as people did in the Old Testament times, wanting the God of Israel but also wanting to worship the Baals, wanting a foot in both camps. That's not possible. For we are the temple of God. We are God's family. We mustn't play around with alternative Jesus, alternative gospels, alternative apostles. You mustn't play around with anything that would contaminate your distinctiveness, your holiness. That is, we mustn't be yoked with it. We mustn't be partnered with it. We mustn't enter into a permanent working relationship with it, believer and unbeliever together in the household of God. Well then, if we've grasped Paul's meaning correctly, what is the application for us now in the 20th century where we are? Firstly, notice that we've limited down the meaning not so as to avoid the applications but so as to clarify it. The Pharisee had a tendency to limit it down so that he didn't have to obey it. That's not the intention. Once you grasp the meaning properly, then you must look out to its widest applications. So let's see firstly its primary application and then some of the wider applications, which I think will give grounds for other questions. The primary application of this passage then is the Christian gospel and church associations. And that is, we cannot be divided in congregational life. We cannot accept the leadership of false shepherds. We cannot work in Christian fellowship with people who preach a different gospel. The Christian church cannot be open-ended and accepting of all viewpoints. It cannot be comprehensive. It cannot be that. The passage is about the purity of the church. And when we're in congregational life, under the leadership the shepherding of people who are false teachers and false preachers who are proclaiming a gospel other than the gospel of the Apostle Paul, a Jesus other than the Jesus of the Scriptures, then we must pull out from it. We must be distinctive. We must have nothing to do with it. That, of course, presents enormous problems for the ecumenical activities. It does present problems, too, for just the denominational affiliations. What do we do when we see leaders of our own denomination moving aside from the gospel and taking the congregations with them? What do we do as we move from one area of Australia to another and we find the church and congregation of one denomination that we have grown up in is under the control of people who do not believe the gospel in another place? We see it over and again as kids come down from the country to settle in Sydney who come from denomination X in the country where the gospel is faithfully taught, and because they're that, they come to the city and they go along to denomination X and the gospel is not faithfully taught in that congregation. But yet they feel there is a loyalty. I've got to stay in, I'm an X. And so I always stay in church X, even though the gospel is not preached, the leaderships do not, based on the gospel is being perverted. The answer is, of course, you must come out. There is absolutely no point or purpose in maintaining and upholding false churches. That's the primary application, but it has wider application. For example, inasmuch as marriage is a household of God, inasmuch as marriage is the church, then it's inappropriate for Christians to enter into.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.